Welcome to the October 28th board meeting. The meeting will now come to order. Mr. Escalante, will you please lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance?
I pledge allegiance
to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Mrs. Stecker, roll call, please.
Mr. Escalante.
Here.
Mr. Kenwood.
Here.
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 Nelson.
Here.
Mr. Ellis.
Here.
Mr. Black.
Okay, great. I think tonight, for purposes of presiding over the meeting, is the board okay with foregoing our first closed session and going straight to public participation and then having our closed session later in the evening? Is that okay?
Yes.
Everybody good with that? All right. Good. Thank you. Public participation, just like to remind everyone, please be respectful and kind. Don't attack anyone. 3 minutes, please. And if it's a topic we've already covered multiple times, please just give us the new points. Do we have any public participation tonight? None? Well, that's my favorite part. Are you kidding me? Nobody? Okay. All right. Hearing none. We have presentations, reports, and initiatives, correct?
We do. We do. We have Karen Carlson, who will be presenting tonight around the academic achievement throughout District 41. She'll be speaking to us about the ISAT data, MAP data, and how it impacts AYP and a number of our subgroups. With that, I'll hand it over to you, Karen.
Okay, so this is our usual annual kind of update on student achievement. So this is the big year, 2014, this spring, of when we are going to have all students, 100% of our students, meeting or exceeding on the ISAT test. And one thing to keep in mind this year is we have our new test scores that were introduced last year that gave us a little glimpse of that, and then those were actually applied this year. So at the bottom of the slide, there are really the kind of the categories at which we look at our subgroup data, and there'll be some slides that highlight that. So we are still governed by AYP, and that's until the state, because of our state waiver, is still pending in that. But it really represents that annual academic performance that we're looking at in reading and math. Subgroups are defined by 45 or more students, and keep in mind that kids may be represented in more than one subgroup. They may fall into a couple of those areas in that. And then AYP is also calculated not only on that academic performance, but we have to have at least 95% of our students participating in the test, and then there's also performance targets for the attendance rate. And that next slide shows you the history of kind of where we've been in that AYP progress schedule since 2004. You can see in 2012, ISB had adjusted that. And so this year, it was 92.5, and then next year, it will be 100%. And that far right-hand column is the attendance rate, which is 92%. And that is typically never an issue for us. The one thing to keep in mind is, okay, Nancy, where you're at there, some of our subgroups can meet AYP by something they call safe harbor, and that's another calculation that the state would apply, and that's if a subgroup reduces its percentage of students not meeting standards by 10% of the previous year's scores. So sometimes you'll see that safe harbor on those individual reports there. So this just kind of gives you an overall description of the ISAT test and the MAP test. Keep in mind, again, 2013 new cut scores, and they actually introduced about 10% to 20% new Common Core questions. And then this coming year for 2014, it will be 100% aligned to the Common Core. So it'll be another new test for the kids. The difference, that's one data point, and then we've got our MAP test. And we know that that's that adaptive test that allows us to see student growth over time.
Karen, can I ask, you said that the ISAT has incorporated about 20% of the Common Core standards in its test on the last one we took, or the one that's coming up?
So the questions were Common Core aligned.
Okay.
On the 2013 test, so for the spring of 2013. We'll be going into the 2014 and it'll be 100% too. Math test had also introduced Common Core-like questions a year ago, so the kids had been somewhat exposed to that. And that's the nice thing about math, since it's computer, it's all on the computer. The future of PERP is a computerized assessment as well. Okay, so here is the ISAT reading data, and it shows it over time. You'll see for this year, 2013, that's when the new cut scores were applied. So you can see that depth. Scores will be seen on the next slide. Kind of keep in mind that 20% new questions and new cut scores. So it's kind of a little bit of a double hit there. The reason for the change in the cut scores, why the state made that, was they were really trying to raise the bar on how well students are prepared to meet that college and career readiness. And they had done some things around the PSAE, looked at it, decided we're seeing a significant drop between our 8th grade ISAT and our 11th grade PSAE, and that's when they started to adjust, why they adjusted those cut scores.
You're using the term cut scores, and that there are people in the audience here. I'm not sure that the definition of cut scores.
A cut score is like a benchmark. This is where you need to be meeting, where you need to be exceeding, and those are established by.
Like a cutoff thing.
Like a cutoff. Mm-hmm. Like at this point, this score equals each meeting, this score equals.
Karen, who determines those?
The state. The next slide shows them that cohort data, again, with the new cut scores applied. What I said in the years past too is our scores consistently have remained fairly flat over time, and then you see the dip that occurred this year with the new cut scores. But then Nancy kind of worked with the data a little bit. I want you to kind of take a look at the next couple of slides. What we did here is this represents the old cut scores. So we applied that same data point to the 2013 scores. And this was just for our own benefit to kind of see where our kids would land. Had the cut scores not changed, this is where we would have been in trying to achieve that 92.5% of our kids meeting or exceeding. So it just kind of gives us a glance. Again, we continued, it still is fairly flat there. However, you had 20% new test questions. So, that's somewhat encouraging there that had they not changed, we would have been fairly consistent going up in a couple places with a few slight dips. And then the next slide.
So is it right when you look at this then that in third and fourth, and then I believe it's sixth and eighth, we either went up a little bit based on the old cut scores or stayed pretty flat where it was in fifth and seventh that we came down a little bit?
Yes. There's a dip at fifth and a different seventh. And remember, those aren't cohort groups, so it's different groups of kids each year, but it still gives you a general sense. Yes. Correct. But then the next slide, this then took those new cut scores, those new cutoff scores, and went back and applied them as if those existed back in 2011 and 2012. So it kind of gives you a sense if you were, to try to compare apples to apples in this case, you can kind of see what that trend would have looked like using those same cutoff points.
So is the benchmark literally, number of right questions? I mean, that's the extent of the benchmark. It's that simple.
And John, we know how you feel about the upset test.
I know. We don't need to go into it.
But yeah, it is about the number of questions that they scored correct.
The most frustrating thing is, we get the results now. It's October, and it doesn't help our kids. So.
Now, it doesn't. But that will be one of the changes with PARC, is it is going to be more real time. Mm-hmm. So that will be an advantage to this now. Okay, Nancy. So here's our math performance, and again, kind of the same look at the slides there. Again, here's just for the past 5 years there, new cut scores or cutoff scores applied this year in 2013, plus 10 to 20% new questions, kind of where they dropped to.
Did they break out, did they tell you what that 10 to 20% questions is and tell you how the kids scored in those regions, those sample questions?
We don't get that level of detail. What they did on the front end is they kind of give you some information, almost like a little bit of a framework. These are the common core standards we're going to kind of focus on. And we noticed, particularly in math, that fractions was on there quite a bit. And that's, we made sure all the grade levels did fractions unit.
Okay.
That it's scheduled to be probably like 4 to 6 weeks anyway, so it wasn't kind of 2 weeks. We're just going to teach you fractions right before the test. But we wanted to be sure, in all fairness to our kids, that they felt better prepared around that area. We also had K-1 and 2 do a fractions unit, just kind of building up to where they would be in third grade, but they kind of timed it, maybe not right.
That's interesting. You mentioned the kids. You were comparing. Did the kids come out of the testing saying, wow, that was harder this year? Or were they...
Feedback from teachers was probably a little mixed review on, you know, some kids said, oh, it was easy, or, you know, that kind of thing, and others said they noticed a difference.
Huge. Okay.
And I think they felt there was more of a difference in the literacy end of it as opposed to math.
Okay.
It's probably kind of being talked about. So the next slide is really the cohort, which we like to see is kind of how that particular group performs over time. Again, it had been fairly consistent or fairly flat there until you've got your new cut scores and introduction of some new Common Core type questions.
And this is, again, with the new questions included.
Correct. So then here we, on the next slide, this takes the old cut scores. Sorry, I keep using that phrase there, but, and then applied it to the 2013 test results as well. And if you look at that, we were a lot closer to 92.5, which is where we needed to be had the cut scores not changed. Again, though, that data over time, kind of fairly flat, every so often a dip here or there as well. And then Nancy also applied the 2013.
So, I'm sorry, but in eighth grade, then...
Are you on the 2012?
I don't know anymore. I'm in 2013.
Okay.
The 77%, that would have been the...
What page are you on? Can you look at the...
I don't have a page number. But it's on the... It's that one right there on the screen. The eighth grade, the 77% red versus the 77% green, those are all under the new cut scores. So we...
Correct.
The trend would be there was no improvement in math this year for the kids in eighth grade.
Yeah, this applies the new cut scores to the old data.
I would say that differently, John. I would
let her answer.
No, go ahead. Well, when you introduce new questions
uh-huh.
that are Common Core aligned and are going to be more rigorous,
right?
Now it's another test, right. And it's a different factor there.
So that's my next question then is, do we know because of MAP or anything like that they were able to answer the quote-unquote harder questions, or?
We don't know for sure because we don't have that type of item analysis to be able to say,
okay.
But I think the more exposure through the MAP test.
Yeah, okay.
Even that, you know, one of the trends we're starting to see is multiple answers can be correct, things like that, and that has been part of their MAP experience. So they are getting used to it. So even though, you know, it looks like there's no growth, the fact that you've introduced more rigorous questions, we could infer.
Yeah,
right.
Okay.
That's how I'm reading that, is the test got harder, but the scores stayed the same. So the kids were taught those Common Core.
But that data is not a cohort, right?
Right, but that isn't. And usually, like, when I look at the screen, you know, I'll kind of go backwards from the cohort. You know, if you look at the 8th grade in the green bar, where the 7th graders in the red bar.
Mm-hmm.
They're the red bar in 7th grade, and then the blue bar in 6th grade to just mm-hmm. kind of show, over time.
And that red bar was pretty high in 7th grade.
It was. Mm-hmm. So
in Paul's summary from last week, You had given us some information about the overall percentage for this data for the state, and it dropped by 23.7% for state overall.
For state.
And for district, our overall scores dropped 12.9%, which is what we're seeing with the new questions in there. Expected that, expected a deeper drop. How did you read that?
You know, and I don't know that we could have predicted kind of where it would have landed. Mm-hmm. I feel like we've been out ahead a little bit mm-hmm. with, well, maybe teachers would tell you not a little bit, it feels like a lot, because we've seen those changes mm-hmm. and have been working with the Common Core. You know, the minute the state adopted it, we kind of embraced it and we started looking at it and deconstructing it and kind of building that curriculum around it. Literacy is probably a year further ahead of math, just because from an elementary teacher's perspective, to have tried to roll that, you know, both of that. And so we started with the mathematical practices and kind of took it a little bit slower. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I would say I'm not surprised, you know. Hopefully, you know, again, we're working with the Common Core. We know that many districts across the state, you know, are still waiting to even begin implementing. And that test is a year from the spring. And, you know, it's not that far away. So hopefully, between what we're doing from a curriculum perspective and the use of the math test where kids are getting exposed to it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, on the final slide with some of the next steps and that, really changing our common assessments that are more common core-y, for lack of a better word. Mm-hmm. I was meeting with the Hadley literacy teachers tonight, and PARC is releasing some sample questions in that, and we're really encouraging teachers to get in there, not only to take the test, but to really look at that format. And they're using that as somewhat of a template to develop their common assessment. And it's not about test prep. It's just getting kids used to kind of a different way of thinking. They're getting that comprehension from a different point of view. Lots of having kids going back into the text. Even their multiple choice questions is a higher level of comprehension than what we were used to seeing. And I think the fact that the teachers are looking at that and studying it and bringing that to their students will help.
Thank you.
So here's just kind of a quick way to really look at our subgroup data, old versus the new. We have scores in that. And if you guys can see that little, fine print at the bottom there. But in blue were the old cut. Is that right, Nancy? The blue is the old cut.
Blue is the new.
Oh,
blue is
new. The new. That little pinkish is up at the top there. It would have been totally reversed on the colors there. So you can see the different subgroups. There's no surprise with our LEP students. We know it takes 5 to 7 years to acquire the English language, and we give them a year. And then they take the test. So, you know, in math, they actually have to take it pretty quickly. So it's a lot to expect from kids who are first learning English language, then to give them a test all in English. And so if you just kind of look at it, just kind of a good way to kind of quickly compare kind of the old versus new by our different subgroups. And this is data that the buildings will look at closely from an individual building perspective, their own subgroup data, and you know, what are they doing to kind of meet their individual needs. But it just gives us kind of that bigger picture. And again, no real surprises there. And I would also remind you too, remember some of our kids will fall into multiple subgroups, so they're counted multiple times.
Karen, there's no, for our limited English proficient students, there's no, I know this, we had this conversation like 4 or 5 years ago when they changed the test from the, I forget what it was called, our bilingual teachers, that particular test from the state.
image.
The image test, right, exactly, which the state took away and said, no, you have to use this test. There's no accommodation as our population, our numbers, or as the district's numbers go up in terms of our LET students to accommodate for that?
Well, there are accommodations that LET students are entitled to. They wouldn't be significant. That would kind of make a difference in that. And, you know, like, there's a cutoff date in May. If they've been here before a certain date, then they have to take the test. They don't count it, though, the first year, but after that, then it is factored in there. Moving forward, some of the initial information that PARC has released, it would appear that they are going to be more sensitive to our second language learners as far as appropriate accommodations and kind of modifications, as well as for our kids who are kind of in the tier system for response to intervention. So we'll kind of continue to study that, and hopefully that will help. You know, one of the things, even for our IEP students, there's will be a text-to-speech feature on the test, which I think will make a big difference for us.
Yeah.
Karen, how many students are in the LEP?
District-wide?
Yeah.
Probably about 400. I don't have an exact number, but, I mean, that is right around that. And, you know, that number's grown significantly for years in the district as well. Okay. And then here's the same information covered by math. So it's just kind of another way of looking at that math data, old scores versus the new scores by subgroup. And then we've got our science scores. If you notice, and we kind of had a conversation last year, we had been seeing a slight decline, particularly at grade 4, with our overall number of students meeting or exceeding. Last year, when we implemented the new literacy modules at the elementary level, remember the social studies content was fully integrated, and part of our hope was that it would free up more time for science instruction, because prior to that, we just shared that time that kind of alternated between science and social studies. We can't totally attribute that to that, but I'm hoping that we're able to kind of spend more time. This year, we'll be spending even more time, but that it did free up some of that, that hopefully that helped that kind of recovery that we saw. It's not significant, but it was nice to see it go back up at fourth grade and slightly at seventh grade. And I know the Hadley science teachers are excited about kind of getting kids back into giving that science is due.
I know we group, you know, the meets and exceeds together. And is there a trend on whether from fourth to seventh, does the meet get higher and the exceed gets lower? Or?
You know, off the top of my head, I couldn't tell you, but we could go back and look at that. Speaking specifically to science?
Yeah, I mean, I think it would, I mean, for all of them, I think it would be just good to understand.
Yeah. The buildings
the,
look at
the
that
top way. Number 91 may be the same, right? But perhaps the meet folks are, we're getting more meet folks as we get older and less exceed folks. And I mean, that's a trend we see in math a lot. I don't know if it's the same.
That's
on
our school report cards, right, Karen?
Yeah,
it's just disaggregated by that.
Yeah. It is. And notice there's no new cut scores in science.
Right.
And now we're going to go on to the MAP data. So here's your MAP reading growth data, and this is looking at scores from spring to spring. So now the percent of students who met their growth target. That middle column, the 2011-2012, we use new NWA normative data, 2011 norms were applied. So overall, we all saw kind of a dip in our scores in general with the new norms having been applied. The other thing, just historically, we don't have as many kids really meeting their growth target when you look at it from spring to spring. On the next chart, when you see fall to spring, more kids will meet their growth targets. The other thing, and Nancy and I kind of talked a little bit about this, you know, what would it look like if we just identified kids who may grow, they may not have met their growth target. A lot of kids could be off by a point and things like that. the buildings pay close attention to this information, and a lot of them are working with the kids on some goal setting around that, and they'll even look at those strands. The other thing, what we saw in between 2012 and then 2013 is NWA introduced a number of Common Core questions as well. So they kind of upped the rigor with their questions in addition. So here's your spring to spring in reading, and then the next slide shows the fall to spring. And you can see, you know, overall more kids meet their growth target when they're looking from fall to spring.
Well, you just said something important, Karen. I know you say this every year, but it gets kind of glossed over. And that is, I feel like sometimes there's a misrepresentation of the growth that students make because of the fact that they didn't hit the target. And some of the principals talked about that, too, that, you know, it could be a 1 or 2 point miss, but we state that they missed target, which I think... for the student, you know, who's working hard, can kind of misrepresent the growth of how hard they're working.
Well, and that was one of the things that when the new norms came out, a big change we saw is in the past, kids had varying growth targets, and the lower your overall risk score, it was a lot easier to kind of make that growth. And then when the new norms came out, all of a sudden it was almost the identical growth targets for all kids, and for some of our kids who are, we've got some little ones who have these really high RIT scores, you know, to make an 11 or 12 point gain when they're already at a RIT band that would be, you know, they could be a second grader or more typical a fifth grader, that's a lot of, you know, growth, and they haven't been exposed to some of that type of content that it's asking them for. Sometimes it's a little bit tougher to meet those targets. Okay, so and here's our map. Again, with the map growth, you can see from the spring to spring, again, not as many kids meet their growth target, and it tends to, you know, usually you would say at the higher end, not as many people need it, but this kind of just proves that, you know, a lot of some of the eighth graders who are still meeting their growth targets there. And then on the next one, when you see the fall to spring, again, far more kids are meeting their growth targets. I think a lot of times, even at the building level, teachers have a lot of ownership over that fall to spring because of the teacher with the child. When you look at spring to spring, it was somebody else's student, typically the spring before, and they don't always go back and look at those, but the fall to spring, there's a lot of ownership for it. And the kids have done goal setting for that year and some of those kinds of things as well.
So none of that's attributable to the summer, not having...
Well, you have a summer, you know, you may have the summer slide or that dip, but then you, you know, usually by the fall you start to kind of recover, and then you see, you still have that fall to spring.
So the fall is post-summer recovery time period?
Not always. Usually the fall, because of the dip, it may be pre-recovery.
Karen, did that actually happen when we're looking at reading? Spring to spring looks like it actually was higher than the fall to spring for reading. By grade level, if you look at it, unless I'm reading it wrong. Am I comparing the wrong thing? Because when I look at like 8th grade, spring to spring, it's 56.9, right?
Correct.
And then if I look at 8th grade, fall to spring, it's 55.8. So that actually went the other way for reading. For math, it went the way you'd expect. Reading almost went the other way.
Right. And you know, and it's not significant. Again,
yeah, it's pretty flat.
Yeah, it is pretty flat. Keep in mind, too, you know, we now have Odyssey, and so, you know, teachers have really encouraged the use of that. We have a number of parents who access it. It's connected to their math scores and their RIT band, and the research behind that's been pretty positive.
Yeah.
You know, kids can spend 60 to 90 minutes a week, and they can show double-digit growth on some of that, so that, you know, can make a difference. And
okay.
For some, they use it as even kind of another level of an intervention, not its own intervention, but they will encourage kids to be on that as well.
Who sets the growth targets?
NWA does.
NWA.
They automatically populate it. kind of based on their norms and sort of thing. So here's the FAFSA Sense Canal. This is something new that we actually added last year. Our teachers at the elementary level administer it at least twice a year. We have more and more who are administering it in the winter as well. But this is another lens at reading. They use writing records, and they kind of get a level of where the students are reading. And the difference you'll see here between the spring of 2012 and the spring of 2013 is prior to that, we had told teachers, you know, only kind of go to a certain level, because for some of our kids, if you kind of keep going and going and going, first of all, it takes a long time because it's administered one-on-one. And so we kind of would put a ceiling there. There were still some teachers who would have gone beyond that. But this past year, we asked them to go ahead, because when they were trying to do the class placements and really kind of trying to create classes of like learners, or groups of like learners within that, they did ask them to kind of see how far they could stretch the kids in that. So you'll see we have more kids, particularly when you look at that kind of that K through 4 range, who fell below that gray box. The gray box is what would be that expectation level, and then how many kids were reading beyond that. You can't go any higher than a Z, so your fifth graders would really kind of end there. And remember, some of those kids could be reading at a Z to start the year as well. Mm-hmm. So it's just another data point for us to kind of look at and kind of see where our kids are at. Obviously, the kids who are up at the top there, reading at those lower reading levels, you know, they could be one of our subgroups, or they might be somebody in the tier process in response to your mention. But the buildings, they have data law meetings where they're really looking at those kids and what's going on with them to kind of help move them along. But it's a good piece of data. It is a one-on-one test, and teachers can do an analysis of those running records, find out what kids are breaking down. So it is a pretty important data point at the building level.
Is the shaded box meets or exceeds?
That would be an end-of-the-year target reading level where we would want kids.
But the target would be at a meeting level.
Yes.
Right.
And those... my first year here, our kindergarten target was like an A. I mean, we really, you know, when we met as a kindergarten group and we said, you got to get them to a B, they're like, there's no way. And as they've, you know, kind of adjusted their instruction, and it's not easy and it's a lot of work, but look at the number of our kindergartners who are leaving meetings. So it's, you know, it's not the kindergarten we went to. And I mean, things are just very mature. Yeah.
So how are these standards different than either Common Core or ISAT? Or?
Well, even FAFSA Sense Canal, they're the authors of the test. They adjusted their end-of-the-year targets to have them be kind of more Common Core aligned. Nancy and I were talking earlier, and it's possible they may even have them bumped up. She was trying to connect with a literacy specialist. I don't know that you could push kindergarten much higher than a D at that point. But it's good to know, although look at, we have, you know, 64 of them were at an E. That's interesting. Mm-hmm. And we look at this at the district level. You know, I don't know that the building kind of captures it in the same way necessarily. I mean, they look at it as individual kids and where they might be. So really the next slide is just the percentage of kids, what that actually equates to, that fall in those kind of buckets there. And then next step, yes, thanks. As I reread this, I've got Common in here quite a bit. So I've mentioned Common Core and Common Assessments and things like that. So, you know, we're continuing to use the map. The use of Odyssey. I have more and more teachers contacting me. They're adjusting those regimes for kids because it's either not hard enough or they've kind of worked through them pretty quickly. So they're moving them along on that. We're implementing the Common Core in the area of math. We're using the Common Planning template. We have our first group of third grade teachers that meet tomorrow. We do have a common pre- and post-assessment in math, and we're looking at the PARC kind of framework on that to develop those, and they've identified kind of three tiers of questions, which range from very skill-type questions to that higher-level application. We have the literacy modules, grades 2 through 8. They're aligned to the PARC content frameworks as well. We also have Common Core District Common Assessments in Literacy this year at all grade levels. We're deconstructing the science standards. That's I was with teachers today, finishing that up. We are just about done. We kind of partnered with some other districts. We're going to have people give us feedback in November, and then the group will come back together. And then we'll start doing our own district-level planning around that, because we'd like to begin implementing the 14-15 school year. The state has not officially adopted. The last I heard from them, they're pretty confident that they will adopt that. So we did roll out an online student self-assessment survey around the district learner characteristics. So we're hoping teachers have run into some glitches. If they didn't print right away, kind of go back and retrieve them. The goal was to share them with parents at conferences, but I don't know if we'll have resolved some of their trying to find, especially at Hadley, 125 that high student population. So, but we'll continue to do that. We'll actually just use that assessment survey twice with the kids, and K and 1 is taking a pencil and paper survey. And then we're really monitoring all the information from PARC in anticipation of the new assessment. We know for sure there'll be it'll be real time, and right now they'll start with 2. There's a performance-based assessment that's about 3/4 of the year into it, and then the final assessment. So we'll continue to monitor kind of what they're sharing and releasing. We do have 3 schools who will participate in the pilot for some of those, Hadley and Forestland and Churchill. And it's just a couple of classes, but you know, I think the teachers are kind of excited mm-hmm. to actually see what it looks like. Forest Glen and Churchill will be all online. Hadley's going to be paper and pencil. Mm-hmm.
So, not sure why.
But so it'll just be, I think, a great experience. And I think Paul, you got an email too that they're still identifying, I think, a few more. So I think our other schools would love to be able to participate.
Yeah.
That's it.
Any other questions for Karen?
I do have some, but
please.
I mean, anybody else want to? A couple of things. So this will be this presentation been posted yet, or will be posted tomorrow? I know the scorecard is out and everything, but
yeah.
I guess if we post this, I think we need to do a little communication piece around cut scores and Common Core and all that, just so that it's, you know, everybody understands it, right?
Julie's already started working on it.
Okay, good. I just have a fundamental question that I ask often, but before that, do the new cut scores drive AYP as well?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So, well, that's good to know.
Well, and that's a bit of a frustration because new cut scores and a whole new test, 100% aligned.
Yeah. So, I go back to, many years ago of talking about more of a local, a local community set of standards, right? Which is, we always talked about we have the ISAP, but then we layer our set of standards on it, and they should be more rigorous, and all that. And when I look at the data, I'm just kind of asking myself, to me it sort of reinforces, and maybe I'm seeing this wrong, that we're teaching to a test, and maybe there's not enough, empowerment by the teachers to teach to a level where, we don't have to worry about this stuff. I my feeling about the state and what it does in terms of standards, and so, should I come away as, you know, we are, you know, this is just a reflection that we teach to the test and we're missing something or not?
No, and I feel like the message we've actually communicated to teachers the past couple of years is to not worry about doing this yet. I mean, we have to report on it, hopefully Judge DeGaulle said, that good teaching is good teaching. And I think our teachers are moving towards kind of being a little bit more of a risk taker. We're seeing more teachers engaging in problem-based learning, which really can start stretching kids through inquiry and trying to reach beyond it. You know, when the Common Core came out, some of the national organizations like NCTM, National Council of Teachers of Mathematics, had said that they felt that now there may be a test worthy of teaching to, because it's going to ask kids to kind of get at that higher level. So I hope we're starting to move beyond and into kind of more of those 21st century skills, the higher level critical thinking, analysis, and application synthesis.
I would echo what Karen just said, really talking about planning, and that teachers are spending time looking at the standards, looking at the Common Core, and really understanding what is it, what's the bar, the state and nationally, have we set for our students? And that's what we should be working from, are those standards. Those standards really guide us, understanding where we expect all students to be, understanding the students who sit in front of us on a daily basis, and how do we continue to get them to achieve and go higher than ever before. I never been one to talk about the test. The test will take care of itself. We do exactly what Karen said. We lean on really great instruction. We understand what the bar that the state and the national standards have set for us, and we move for that. I don't like the stop and let's prep for a test. That's not something I support. I've never supported as a teacher or principal, chief academic officer, or superintendent. I expect that our teachers are well-planned, thoughtful, really creating thinking opportunities for our students on a daily basis. That's going to win out all the time. That's what colleges and universities are looking for, are students who can think, students who can apply, and that's what businesses are looking for our students. Students who can think all the time. That's what we're trying to create, using the standards as our guide.
Mm-hmm. Now, I would say, John, to your point, and I know that you've been vocal about this over the last few years, and it's been a good, you know, counterpoint to, you know, the annual review, right, of this. But I think starting years ago, 4 or 5 years ago or more, that the messaging was, you know, good effective teaching will take care of the test. It's not been my sense when my children were in District 41 that there was heavy focus by teachers on exacerbating anxiety, any of that around the test. And I think our shift toward PBL and really active integration of critical thinking skills or learner characteristics all support, I think, what, you know, John's been talking about, which is just good facilitation and good teaching. So,
I mean, I think we made huge progress when we took the ISAT as the key measure of every building. You know, we'd get the, mm-hmm. I forget what they would call it, we'd get the building goals. And
school information.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were all about the ISAT. So we got that out, and I just want to make sure that cascades to the teachers, and they know they're empowered to bring the best out of their kids, and then this will take care of itself.
And it's been a little hard. I remember even getting the teachers to focusing on the really 5-paragraph essay. It had been so ingrained in them because of the ICAT test, mm-hmm. it was hard for them to let go of something like that, because that's not what they're looking for anymore. No, we're not really assessing writing at ICAT, but we have moved away from that at the district level. Mm-hmm. And it was hard to give that up, because that's what they knew.
You can't text 5 paragraphs.
And you don't have to have everything spelled correctly either. So.
Great.
Okay.
Thank you.
Karen, thank you so much. Thanks for all your leadership. I appreciate it.
Am I supposed to do this or you not?
So I'll be next, but
okay.
So the next piece we have is the elementary school facility planning. I'll kick it off and hand it over to Bob here in a second. What we have tonight is an opportunity to look at the cost. We've been talking about a range of somewhere between $10 and $14 million tonight. FQC, Jack and Fred will be talking in detail about the cost of the overall project. The schematic designs have not changed. There's been no significant changes to the design of the facilities. So tonight, really, the focus is about the cost, the overall plan. To recap again, we're looking at a two-phase plan. The first phase is obviously this one that we've been talking about for the last few weeks, but it does connect into a larger phase two where we are looking at possible referendum, possible new elementary school that would be in the range of 550 students. You'd be looking at roughly 110, 120 students from each of the elementaries coming to the new elementary school, which would give us flexibility in our schools that we've been looking for. People say, well, if you're building a new elementary, why do you need these new classrooms? You do need them. You need them for the simple fact of the changing needs of our students. Full-day kindergarten. If we really are honest with ourselves, half-day kindergarten is 2.5 hours long, with half hour of that being, and again, I really support it, but in the specials electives for the art, the music. So you have 2 hours. And if we go back to connect with what Karen was just talking about, the changing rigor for our students, for our five-year-olds, who by the time they're in the kindergarten, they should be reading, they should be writing. The complexity level a little bit different, but still, they're reading and writing, something very different. Again, connecting back with what Karen said, it's a different kindergarten than what we're used to, than what any of us attended. So really, having an opportunity to offer District 41 community a full-day kindergarten opportunity here. We'd be looking at two additional classrooms at each of the buildings for that. And then there's other possibilities for classroom space, bringing home some of our students who are receiving specialized instruction in other districts. We have to, because of our limited space, we're not able to house all of our students in our facilities. So maybe to be able to increase that space for our students. There's a possibility of looking at some preschooling. But those are pieces that the board would have to take on. The second phase is very conceptual in nature, from land acquisition to the type of facility. Is it a neighborhood elementary? Is it a magnet school? Those are big conversations that still need to happen. But the beauty of phase one and phase two, even if there's some reason either the community doesn't support a referendum or the board doesn't move that piece of it forward, phase one is still a really good plan. It reduces our reliance on portables by half at the elementary level. It creates new flexible space that can be used in any teaching environment. That's what I love about these spaces. These spaces are designed for flexibility. From flexibility of furniture on the walls that move around, there's nothing affixed to the walls, to the spaces, even the flexibility of being able to go out into the outdoor classroom space, ensuring that our kids have those opportunities and our teachers have those opportunities to create those thinking, collaborative opportunities that Karen and our teachers and our principals so desperately want. So these spaces are important now, and they're important in the long view of where we can go. Some of the hard parts for the community is, as you talk about this, as you talk really about that phase two, many of their students, our students, won't be in the elementary schools anymore. But it's really about seeing this district as our district, no matter where your kids are at, that this is an important investment in Glen Ellyn, short term and long term. So I like this plan. I believe in this plan. I am excited for Jack and Fred to talk to you a little bit more about the cost. What does it look like from the hard and soft cost But I appreciate all the work that Ron and FGM did, giving us some initial pricing that really kept us in the ballpark. We knew the range that we were going to be in, and actually we're right under that with our soft cost. So with that, the board should be reflecting upon those four questions I sent to you on Friday around the overall plan, that phase one and phase two, understanding that phase two is conceptual in nature. There's a lot of work to be done there. But in a conceptual framework, it's there for you, and that you see how it connects to phase one. The second one is, does the board support the specific phase one proposal of adding those 16 flexible 21st century classroom spaces to each of the elementaries? And then on November 11th, will the board approve phase one of the plan and request that the staff begin the construction bid process? That's what November 11th is. It is to look at staff, myself, and Bob, and say, let's move forward with the bid process. And bids would come back to you probably late February, March time frame. And then finally, and the one where Finance Committee left off on, and I had to bring it to an abrupt end, so I apologize about that. Does the board support the Finance Committee's recommendation when they bring forward a recommendation? But we're going to have some of that. We're going to extend that conversation today as to how would you use your monies, the fund balance. You have money within fund balance, or you've heard from a couple banking institutions around alternative funding. So those are important pieces as you guys reflect on this conversation. But with that, I'm going to hand it over to Bob to kick us off.
Well, I think your four comments right there pretty much summarize what I was going to say, particularly the amount of hard and soft costs that are going to be presented in just a moment. And then also I think it's important to ultimately get to the conversation in terms of how we're going to fund these projects, whether through part or all of fund balances and ultimately or possibly through a borrowing alternative too. So really I think Paul covered what I needed to say. I'd like to bring Jack from FQC up and let him present his cost estimates, and then we'd open up the floor for any comments that you may have or questions you may have.
I said, you have nine?
Right? Yep. Sorry, Bob, it took away your thunder.
I'm happy to kind of jump into this at any point that you want me to because of the conversation that we had earlier. I will add one thing to the conversation about the time frame. We are looking at trying to come back. If everything goes through the November 11th board meeting and proceeds forward, you'll have your conversation leading to a decision about funding. From our standpoint, and you can put this into your conversation however you want to, we're going to go to bid, we're going to get bids, we're going to come back to the board end of February, beginning of March. That's really the time frame from our standpoint that you need to make the decision to fund the decision. Up until that point in time, we're just getting the information. So just to put that into the... As well.
I appreciate it. So, Jack, would you talk to us about the hard and soft costs? We'll start there, and then we'll kind of move through that conversation.
So, in tab 9, you have a two-page summary document, essentially designed around the first page being all the hard costs. Those are the dollars that have to go into doing the actual bricks and mortar construction, not Ron's costs, not putting furniture in the building, not paying for permitting fees, but the cost to build the building, broken down into vertical construction, which is building construction, site construction, which is the work associated with getting the site prepared so that we can get pad ready and bring the utilities, the stormwater detention, which is something that you're all very familiar with. We are carrying a 10% contingency, and then the services associated with FQC, as your construction manager versus having a general contractor, brings the hard cost to $13.16 million. On the second page are your soft costs associated with the mobiles, relocating or demolishing. We have spoken with your vendor for your mobiles, so those are some pretty good numbers that we feel confident in. There will be some additional technology infrastructure required to accommodate the additional classrooms, and that's so that will be additional money that's the district will use to fund that equipment purchases and installation of some security, to extend security into these additions. FF&E, furniture, fixtures, and equipment. We've only allotted a small amount of additional funding for that in this project for the art room at Churchill, because the other furniture either already exists, if I'm saying this correctly, Bob, in the portables, or it's already part of your ongoing process of renewing the furniture. Line items for FGM and their associated consultant engineers. We've put in a small allowance for some asbestos abatement in some areas that may need to be remodeled. And then we have some other expenses associated with the project, just to make sure that we don't forget anything, that there's money allocated from soil borings and permits, builder's risk insurance, which is something that the district purchases for the construction process. And then we have a miscellaneous category that we've been carrying for soft costs, or that Ron has been carrying, that we carried forward. And then we put an escalation factor. Behind that is a more detailed breakdown that shows how we got to primarily the hard cost for construction. And the purpose of sharing that information with you is to, one, make sure you know we're doing our job, giving you the level of detail that you're asking us to provide, and to make sure Fred gets credit for the work that he's put into working with Ron and his crew in looking at, you know, how many square feet of masonry walls have to go off, how many interior walls, and how many square feet of paint, how many square feet of vinyl composition tile. So we're not just throwing numbers at this thing. We're actually looking at what it's going to take to build it, what we have to buy and execute in putting the work into place. And we've given a total for the building, which is on this detailed breakdown, is at the top of page 4 of 5, breaks the building down by the subtotal of the building cost. And it shows you the approximate cost per square foot for the vertical construction. And I wanted to point that out to you because they range from about $220 a square foot to $258 a square foot, which, if I remember correctly, Ron, that tracks pretty well with what you experienced at Hadley, or the district experienced at Hadley for the work that you did there. So, from an integrity standpoint, the numbers seem to all be coming together and tracking with your recent experience. And then we've got the site cost, which we've got a lot of engineering to put on based on their visits with the village and looking at your past experience on site. So I'm going to stop talking.
May I just make a suggestion before we get to questions? We have two guests that just arrived here. It's not very often that we get, you know, the elite crowd that shows up. And I didn't know if you guys were here for public participation or not. Are you? So we already had public participation, but would you guys be okay if, so that they have homework to do and they've got to practice more soccer because they don't do that enough? So are you guys ready maybe to just give us your public participation and then we'll go to questions? Is that okay? Yeah. Is that okay?
Okay.
Sorry, guys, for the interruption, but
anywhere you want.
It's not often that, you know, we get... You guys can...
However you want.
However you
that's
want.
However you're the most
that's
comfortable.
Perfectly fine.
You just need to say name and address, right?
Yeah.
I'm Sammy Harris.
And I'm Emma Wallace.
Are you Glen Allen resident?
Yeah.
Okay.
We had Mrs. McGarrow in 6th grade. She had her 6th and 7th. And she wasn't, like, just a teacher. She was a friend who we could go to and talk to whenever we, like, had something.
Yeah, and she was, like, she always was wondering about, like, our soccer schedules to, like, come and see us. And she was just, like, always there.
And most teachers at Hadley, they're good teachers, but they don't have a personal aspect sometimes, and she, like, put in the effort to make a relationship with each and every student, then it was different than most of the teachers.
Yeah, and she was, like, willing to help you out, like, one-on-one to, like, actually help you get better.
Could I just add to that? We spontaneously were just driving by after soccer and caught on as we realized something was happening to one of their favorite teachers that they've had. And it's rare when you have a teacher that lifts you up. You have teachers that can help you maintain, you know, you can get your status quo, you can get the scores that they, you know, that they want you to get on tests. But my child became a child that could not do this. Spontaneously, on the fly, tried to speak, not knowing what she wanted to say, but knowing she wanted to stand up for a teacher that she loved, cared about, and felt that she made her a better person. Emma had it for 2 years, and was fortunate enough to have her for 2 years. Sandy was very upset when she didn't get her for seventh grade. She was there emotionally for them, and she made them stronger kids. These are two kids that are extraordinary students. I never brag about my child. But she's a good student. She's a good kid. Emma's a good student. I mean, they're really good students and really good kids. And they wanted to come here and tell you how they felt.
Thank you guys for coming out tonight.
Yeah.
It means a lot.
Thank you. You would have waited.
Yeah, another hour
to speak, so I didn't want to. I know you guys have homework to do.
Thank
you. You do me a favor, walk back to Mrs. Decker and give her your address. It's part of the public participation piece.
And you guys are welcome to stay if you like.
Yes, you're more than welcome to stay.
We're going
to
talk numbers here.
We're going to be here all night, so.
Thank you.
Thanks for
everything. Yeah.
All right, I'm sorry.
I don't know. Please, that was great.
Apologize. All right, back to questions.
Well, I just have a question about the schedule, because I was looking through it, and I just went through and made notes as I was reading through it. And I'm just wondering, we talked a little bit about this in the initial presentation before we had all the numbers, but what is the mitigation, as you look at the schedule and knowing what we need to accomplish, are there some activities that are in the schedule that you think are more at risk of not meeting that deadline versus others? And just from, you know, a district standpoint or our standpoint, looking at the schedule, that reality check, I was just curious about that.
You know, I hate to keep banging this drum, but from where I stand, the only real risk that we have in terms of accomplishing the schedule all ties back to DuPage County stormwater permitting requirements. Getting the design done, getting through the process, making sure that we have the tabular summary approved, and getting the actual permit to proceed. Now, we've gotten nothing but positive indications, am I correct, Ron?
That's right.
So,
you're not on a limb.
The village is, you know, characterizing it as, I don't see any reason why this can't be done. Is that fair?
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
What feedback have you gotten? Has the city or you talked to DuPage County Stormwater?
We met with the village engineer, mm-hmm. and we went through all of the designs and our design assumptions, because they're key assumptions that they need to verify, and they gave us no indication that our assumptions were wrong, and so now we need to get into the meat of the design effort and then present the designs to them. So.
And then what about DuPage Stormwater Management?
Well, we'd be working through the village.
Authorizing agent.
Right, on behalf of the county. They would implement the guidelines.
Are they a waiver community for any of our projects? Or?
No, we are not applying for any variances for design or stormwater management.
But so as a result of that, because they're going to comply with the requirements, Glen Ellen is actually then the permitting agency on behalf of the county.
On behalf of the county. So right. It's only a submittal requirement to the county, not an approval requirement by the county.
Right. So you know, the since the process has become sort of compressed, and there's an overlap, and I know you'll remember this from the Hadley project, that, you know, because we're going out to bid, you know, early winter, The permitting process will be running parallel to the bidding process. So it's conceivable the county or the village may come back, you know, during that approval process and tweak or adjust things, which they do.
But here's the key question.
Yes.
The key question is what? Who has the authority to issue the permit for the stormwater management?
Well, we'll be getting that from the village, the agency authority.
So it is only a submittal process for stormwater to DuPage County.
Right. Right.
Okay.
But not applying for
variance. That's the key thing in this.
But situation. DuPage has to approve the
it's, work. The rules are one and the same. The village may be a little bit more stringent in some areas. They have their own layer of bureaucracy, I guess, design. Guidelines, so they may be a little bit more stringent in some areas, but so we would be complying with the village process.
This is only an issue for Lincoln at this point, just because of the timeline, right? In other words, there's more.
Just to throw a little more into that issue, what we're talking about right now, and this is a very recent conversation, is if we can get through the process for all four sites simultaneously, we may want to bring some of the site work from Churchill and Forest Glen forward into this year,
next summer,
into this first year.
But let's get back to the approval and permitting process. You still have to make a submittal for Ben Franklin regarding all this, and they still have to review all your requirements and make sure your calcs are correct.
Yeah,
that you have the capacity.
Yeah, but
it's that we don't have.
Erica's question was around the risk and the timeline, and what we're talking about here is in terms of these permits. At least the plan that's here, it would only, there are two permits we need, or however many, but we need them for two sites, right? And it sounded like your response was around stormwater, and it sounds like we think we're pretty good on Franklin in terms of a risk. Still need to get the word, but Lincoln is the one that was the riskier one in terms of getting that approval based on our last conversation. Has that changed or not changed?
Actually, yeah, the design has been greatly simplified. Basically, we're going to be creating a separate detention area associated with the west wing. Mm-hmm. The east area, the existing detention, is going to remain as is at this point. No parking, no stormwater.
No storage.
On the east side. It's going to be self-contained, so we feel pretty comfortable that process can move forward also.
Okay. So that's less of a risk than it was last time.
Right. Absolutely.
And I thought that years back when we were talking about doing something at Lincoln, I thought we had to go to another agency as well, besides just DuPage and the village. And I don't remember what it was, but is there a EPA thing or near the flood zone thing?
Well, we're on there completely. We're not touching that, right? We're not in that. According to the FEMA flood maps, we're not in that area. We're not touching anything in that area.
So that's not required, even though the property is on.
Right.
The Army Corps of Engineers redid that floodplain a couple of years ago,
right.
And you and I attended the village meeting. So that may be what you were thinking of.
Yeah, there was a time where we had to go through another hoop.
With wetlands and other things. So the lands actually do have to go through the Corps and other groups.
And there's nothing with Milton Township either, or is that?
No.
Okay.
It's a county. It's a countywide guideline that's implemented by the local jurisdiction.
Yeah, the reason I brought that up just in terms of thinking of the project management part of this is we've, done projects so recently with the village that's, we have a good relationship with them. And I think, Bob, you've talked a lot about this, and it lowers my concern that this type time schedule is going to get hiccuped by that. So that's why I asked.
Matt and I have met with the village on a couple of occasions and received nothing but expectations. So we let them know that that we've ramped up our thoughts on the possible implementation regarding Lincoln, and they're endorsing it, especially when we speak to reducing our reliance on portables.
Exactly. That was the other point you made. Yeah. Good. Thank you.
Picking on the stormwater and moving over the cost off the schedule.
I just want to make sure I answer your question, or you heard the answer to your question, that it is the village on the stormwater.
Yeah, and that's the key component that I was trying to get across.
And just also on the permitting, for both these locations, correct me if I'm wrong, Ron, but we do have to go, because of the intergovernmental agreement that is decades old between Glen Ellyn and the district, we do have to go through the village for the building as well, correct?
Design review.
Design. We could go through a design review too. So everything is permit driven at this time. It's not complexity of project or duration driven. It's per meter.
And it's all housed in the village. So
yes, it's all with the village.
Stop. Shop.
Right. With the per meter.
So.
And the cost, looking at the schedules for cost and all that regarding stormwater, a couple questions. One, have the borings, the geotechnical reports been submitted yet?
No, the borings have just been completed within the past couple of weeks and we have not gotten the results.
When do we expect the results from?
Within a week or two ago, it was 2 weeks or 3 weeks.
So a couple days or so?
Very soon, yeah, sure, okay. Very soon.
Because we use conventional foundations, conventional slab, and that's the wild card in any site work is the conditions of your soils. Was there any allowances still left in the CB's numbers for that?
Yeah, we did use some allowances, plus we had the 10% contingency on the overall budget as well. So
I think there's still a substantial allowance.
We have allowances just for suitable soil materials.
Right.
So you know off the top of your head, Fred, what that allowance is? And that's fine if you don't. And the question is in the earthwork number, mm-hmm. Is that where it is, or is it in the site utilities and the stormwater?
You've got enough soil allowance in your earthwork.
It's in the earthwork number?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's the one that's about $1.3 million or so?
Mm-hmm. For Churchill.
Mm-hmm. And that's why if you look at the square foot for a square foot cost, just everybody, if you look at that, you see Lincoln at $61 and Churchill at $78, which is magnitudes higher than the other two.
Mm-hmm.
So I understand.
And the square foot cost, you mentioned this earlier, but this is you connected this back to the three special education classrooms that we built with the air funds. Is that what you said? That was our last one. That was the last building we did.
That's our last benchmark. Right.
Okay. And that these are
in line
with that. That's good. That's 2 years.
Just to Churchill alone, because of the amount of fill and compaction that we're going to be using, we're going to be about $422,000 there for
428. Okay. So that's over and beyond normal conventional.
Yeah.
And you're still trying to balance the sites and all four together.
Yeah. The idea is that the possibility of we can start the site early enough, we can take the dirt that we're pulling out of other sites, bring them over to Churchill, so we wouldn't have to buy dirt later on.
Four store.
That's why we're trying to push and expedite this so we can balance across sites.
There's some fairly large potential swing some dollars there.
If you guys looked in last meeting, we talked about potentially moving to spring construction 2015 for those schools if we move those portables.
Yep.
We are looking into that, and that may even help with the...
possibly the access.
Access and balancing the space.
Absolutely. Okay.
More questions, Joe?
Go ahead. That was just more on the site where the variable could be higher, so I want to make sure we're covered on that. But if other people have questions,
yeah, I was just going to ask, so last time we were, you know, pretty wide range, right, 11 to 19. We're now 15.5. This is, you know, the probability or confidence of the 15.5. Are we 100% sure? We've got all the contingency in.
No, we're
80% sure. 90%.
What did you say, Jay?
We're 90% sure, and we have a 10% contingency. So based on the scope, you know, that Ron said this a little bit earlier. I think I'm just between the three of us, but you know, the scope of this project, contingent on approval, is going to stay pretty consistent with where it's at. So we feel really good. We've tightened the numbers up as much as we can at SD level. The variable here is going to be exactly how much we have to spend on the site based on the permitting requirements. That's going to be where if there's going to be a swing outside 10%, it's going to be on the site. But we're carrying, you know, $1.1 million in contingency, so we feel good.
When you say the site, you mean in terms of leveling it or?
No, making compliant with all the stormwater requirements.
The building itself is pretty straightforward.
So it still goes back to the stormwater.
And geotechnical, that's for.
Yeah, but I mean, we haven't heard anything. We haven't, I mean, anything that's going to push us beyond the allowance that we're talking about.
The building pads aren't really large, so we feel that, you know, working with the dirt that we have.
So you feel very confident with the contingency you've built in, that this number is the number we're going to be working off of.
Yeah, we went from a hard cost range of 11 to 15, is where that was at. Mm-hmm. And now our hard cost is at 13 with a million and so in contingency. So we're really, instead of being 11 to 15, we're in a 12 to 13 range, mm-hmm. I guess is probably a good way to think of it. Mm-hmm.
I have some small questions on some design stuff, if that's okay.
Please.
Just on, I think we're doing allowances for roof screening at this point. Is that probably true? Because we don't have exact
vision screens.
Yeah. What feedback have we gotten in the village on the screening? Anything? I mean, there's a lot.
They're thrilled with that we had them in there.
Yeah. Well, what you choose changes the cost a lot. So
yeah, they'll be simple.
Simple and right. Cost effective would be the best way, clearly. I know in Lincoln there's no skylights in the corridors.
Wait, is that a question? Or
that is, well, that's a statement, yeah, because that's what I read.
Would not, because it has glass. It has a glass wall at the corridor. They're single loaded corridors.
Right, they're different than the others because they're single loaded as a double loaded. I just wanted to understand why.
Yep. And that'll be facing into the outdoor classroom area.
And then at Lincoln, where we're connecting on the corridors, we're taking outward doors on the current classrooms now, and there's no doors designed for the outside of those two doors.
We haven't gotten that deep into the design yet, but we could put those on the outside wall, the north and the south wall, rather than the west. You're talking about Lincoln?
I'm talking about Lincoln for the existing classrooms that you're now going to go up and build the corridors.
Right, right. We can move those doors to the north wall and modify the windows, possibly.
North wall. I'm not following. I'm sorry. The existing classrooms right now that are there, where you're adding the corridor is going in. They're kindergarten rooms now. I have a kindergarten, so it's easier.
Yeah, the existing classrooms.
So the existing classrooms, you're taking the outside door, and that's where you're putting the corridor. I looked at the design.
Right.
You would be on the west wall into the courtyard, you would most likely put.
We could do that, yes.
Because I thought the goal would be to have outside doors for those two classrooms, too.
Yeah, that's entirely possible. We'll get to that point.
Okay. And final design.
Correct.
Just bringing it up as long as I'm looking at the plans.
Yep.
I have a design question if you want me to pile on that.
Yeah, go right on it.
I know at one point we had talked about the Franklin Gym and the way this was being done. We were locking that into a structure that had to stay that way. Is that true, or are we allowing flexibility with the gym if we need to do something later?
Well, these classrooms will butt up against that building, but we've had the conversation that that building now accommodates in excess of 600 kids, and we really can't imagine that building or that space needing to grow much larger than it currently is.
So we're saying that the gym facilities, according to the principals and gym teachers, is fine for 600 kids school.
That's correct. And we still have the MPR, the multi-purpose room that the kids use also.
And within that school, we have two PE teachers, physical education teachers. That gym, along with the Churchill gym,
There's the
two largest gyms in the district, and with two PE teachers, really you would need to hire an additional teacher to have even more classes in there. They're using that space as often as possible, but it is our largest space in the district. It wouldn't be one that we would look to be expanding in the future because of its size. But you are correct that it is the new space would lock it in to where it currently is.
If they say it from an infrastructure perspective, it's fine, and that's why it's not always what we've heard, so I just want to make sure we're on that page. And then from a design perspective, so I just want to make sure I read this properly, but essentially the rooms that we're designing, they're 900 square feet each, and they are separated by a movable wall.
Correct.
Right? So the sound between the two classrooms with this movable wall, you guys are fine with, I assume that wall is going to be closed most of the time initially, and I can experience problems with the class next door is too loud. And
they're acoustically rated panels. In fact, we had that discussion about glass and other materials too, so we want to maximize that acoustic sound soak capability. The panel is going to be a fairly thick panel. Sound soak. Right. 50.
And what does that mean?
It's a high rating, a lot like your banquet facilities and so forth, so it's a full, more intimate panel. And the only empty seat as well.
And then it sounds like the design of these rooms long term are for STEMrise. They were designed with that in mind, long term.
That would give you that flexibility.
I have some questions in the minutes. First of all, thanks for putting all the sets of minutes in here because it wasn't helpful because it just, you know, I know some of us weren't in that conversation, so we go back and really read through it. In the September 24th minutes, which is page 2 of 21 and tab 10, you talk about church site access, and it comes up in a couple places where the possibility of grabbing some extra space for emergency access, et cetera. Can you talk a little bit about that? I'll just read it. It says, church site access. The district has given serious thought to acquiring additional property at the northwest corner of the site.
Yes.
That piece.
Okay. What's the status of that?
Yeah, this is back in September.
So, Bob and I actually were on site Friday afternoon speaking with one of the homeowners who owns a substantial amount of property back there. Mm-hmm. One of his concerns is that he is looking to put his property up for sale along with a number of other homeowners in that area to sell it as a large
parcel.
So he is... He's open to the conversation, but we're going to have further conversations with others.
Just to
Bob.
And the genesis of that is that you can't get to where we need to build the addition.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to get there somehow, and the conversation from the last board meeting about the sequencing of where the portables are at and maybe moving portables initially is one path that we didn't think was available to us, that through this conversation, maybe it is available to us. The other conversation is, can we get access through the northwest corner of the property from a slot of land that the district already owns?
Mm-hmm.
And that's where that comment came from.
And I think we have one more that we're looking at, but we're not too sure about yet, is actually off the east side of the building.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Off the park district side.
Okay.
There's a couple options still available to us.
I'm trying to think of that property back there. The other thing that was helpful in the minutes was the kind of the iterative comments of the principals as they, you know, kind of weighed in as this went along. And I just want to reinforce, a couple things. One was a request by Mrs. Hornacek at Forest Glen about possibly having 6 classrooms. And I know that that's been set aside, but it was interesting to see that just in terms of thinking, how do we kind of maximize that space a little bit. The other one was Mr. Klesfitz at Churchill and his desire to get rid of those older portables. And I walked over there the other day, over the weekend, and just took a walk around because I hadn't looked back there. And, while it would be nice, I know it came up, it would be nice to have that parking space back. You know, they've accommodated for that for several years now, and I think, that at least for me, it's honoring what the principal is seeing at these schools and kind of what the needs are. So, and those are pretty hackneyed, those portables in the back. So that was helpful. So thank you for including this.
You also note, since we're talking about Churchill, that the future construction would be of a 2-story classroom addition.
Right, that's what we had talked about. That would be off the west end of the new addition. We would then proceed. If you wanted to permanently house 600 kids in Churchill, we would come back with potentially a 2-story classroom component there.
And would that 2-story be 4 classrooms?
It could be 4, it could be 6. We need to get into that level of detail because everything hinges on the diamond. Are we keeping that diamond or is that being converted to classroom? So there's a lot of push and pull. And if you recall, the office reconfiguration and relocation is to be factored in. So that final classroom count, I think, is in that phase 2 discussion because we still need to do modifications to Lincoln and Churchill. And then we need to reassess core infrastructure like your cafeteria and gym at Franklin, sort of reassess where we are based on that phase 2 discussion.
I'd like to go to the phase 2 discussion, but I'm not, not until everybody's done with their questions on design and numbers.
Well, one thing I like kind of on phase one here is that you've got a good description of these flexible classrooms. You kind of highlight in our tab one the key components of it. I think that's very important for us to continue to communicate to everyone in the community. I think promoting what we've done at Hadley with the flexible space there, the LMC, is very important. I think that's, you know, consistent with what we're trying to do here in the 21st century classrooms and providing the ultimate flexibility to the building managers, the principals, you know, for the schools. I like what you do on the first tab around the details, what we need to see as a board and what we need to communicate out to the public, what we're going to be providing in this classroom. Well, thanks for being here.
Paul, if I can jump up to those comments there before we go to phase two. We're going to be voting next to, you know, like you said, the fourth thing. And, of course, like Joe's saying, community involvement. Can we? We don't want to publish this whole thing, for God's sakes. But, I mean, is there, you know, you've done it before, small schematics, nice little pretty pictures with the kids on them or whatever. Put something down that we can put it. And said, you know, this is what we're talking about in voting November. We might get a lot of green sheets November 11th, or we might just, but it's good to know. This is what we're doing. This is what we're going to spend $15 million on.
Well, you know, the PowerPoint that I gave at the last meeting was very visual, very graphic, mm-hmm. and to the point with what the goals were and our design goals. Yeah. So maybe we update that with current funding information. And
yeah.
That'd be good. And Julie, could you speak a little bit about what you've done on the website and how people can kind of follow this conversation?
Yeah, I mean, we have our facilities page on the website, which we've meant to look at these conversations. It does have on there quite a bit of the materials. It has a more condensed version of the PowerPoint because we didn't want to put the detailed building diagrams out there for safety reasons. But it does have the diagrams and conditions that show us where on the buildings they are proposed to be. So a lot of materials are posted on the facilities page. We've also tried to provide kind of a history of the conversation and as it's developed. So those pieces are linked to as well.
Okay.
And this project starting in the July conversation and then going forward along with other facilities work that
I just want to make sure that you know we're putting out, this is what we're not voting for funding mm-hmm. enough,
nope.
but this is what we're going to do. This mm-hmm. is your long term future of your community. You know our e-blast. Your I think you send mm-hmm. you know, your
my letter.
Maybe we can get our principals and their e-blast mm-hmm. links from the school's websites. All of that, so we can say. This is how we're doing it. Go look at it. Direct links, you know.
And I would also say
public, you know, published or printed copies here for those community members that aren't internet savvy. You know, here you go, boom. So.
And I would also say that the newspapers, the local newspapers, have covered this very well. Both Josh, Mary, in attendance tonight. That has been out there. I think we've tried to be as transparent as humanly possible. Giving our community, what are we doing? What is the conversation that's happening up here every other week? I believe they've been able to capture those conversations and put that out. And I appreciate what you're saying in a different way and connecting to different groups of people. So everyone has an understanding of where we're at. You can visit our website or you can hear from the independent reporters who have been reporting on this since. Well, for years and years and years. Yeah. Maybe not these two individuals, but others who've been talking about this.
Well, this even came up at PTA Council this morning, Patrick, conversation. Paul was there and gave an overview of what we're doing tonight. Drew was there as a foreground mm-hmm. and spoke about kind of where we are in the process and what we're talking about. And it created some good conversation, very positive conversation, excited. And there was a PTA Council member who actually recommended that PTA council members, presidents, go back and listen to the April 8th board meeting where we kind of came to the previous board discussion around where have we been, our facilities, where are we now, where are we going, and that each board member was able to give their own kind of weigh-in on that. That was helpful. So, you know, it's not for lack of there being opportunities mm-hmm. to get after this. So, you know, this is community has to step up and you know, grab the information too.
I'm not backed up by much fact here. It's more opinion, but I still think we're missing the boat a little bit in how we're getting out to people because, we can garner a lot of people into these meetings when we have something that's contentious out there, usually driven by the community and not by us. But I think there's still a very large group of people in District 41 who don't have any children in District 41, who don't get access, who never look at our website. You know, the newspapers are really our only avenue right now mm-hmm. at that, and I still think we need some kind of an outreach program mm-hmm. where maybe as board members or something else we start to identify community groups and other places we can go to maybe take this presentation we're talking about and get on their agendas. So these are people without kids so that they can see what we're doing to help the community. I think you talked about it rather well about this isn't just, you know, in all reality, a lot of the kids that are in there now won't get use of this, you know, and there's going to be people who will move into Glen Ellyn in the future who are going to be the benefactors of this. But we have to make the case for why we're doing this. We have to get out to people that don't have kids in our school and aren't reading this and aren't coming to meetings and really don't care about it. Because what they're going to hear, even though we're not asking for funding right now, what they're going to hear is, wow, get ready. They're coming after you, and they're going to raise your taxes. And we've got to make sure people understand this is money that we've got access to, we've been saving for these types of things, and that we put this communication plan in place properly.
That goes to the communication workshop.
Yep. Yeah. I agree with you. I would say that a high percentage of people that have kids in our schools don't know we're doing this.
Yeah.
Right? Because I don't think that we have the outreach and, you know, that needs to get done. Where I differ a little bit, though, and I agree with you, it has to be done, and you know, unfortunately, we got a short window to do it because we got to vote on this in November, right? Mm-hmm. Where I disagree, though, is, you know, I worry when we say, they're going to think we're coming after you for money and it's going to raise your taxes. Well, guess what? We are, because there's a phase two. And there's a long-term plan, right? And what I worry about is when we communicate this, what's the long-term plan, right? So the long-term plan has a phase two. It's not defined yet. That's mm-hmm. fine, right? But the phase two does say whether you're going to add more additions on the existing buildings to get the other classrooms done, or whether you're going to build a new school, mm-hmm. or whether you're going to do whatever you're going to do to Hadley, it does mean we're going to ask for money.
Exactly.
In the form of a referendum, I think.
Exactly.
And I'm kind of curious, I don't really know where all you guys sit on that, but when I look at phase two, I'm saying it's an asking for money phase, which is part of our long-term strategy, which is why we're doing this. And I don't know.
So for part of the communication, though, mm-hmm. before we get to phase two, where there's already a lot of opinions out there, you know, one way or another on phase two, I think it's important to start to educate people that are not parents of students in D41 for what the plan is, what we're doing now, how well we're planning what we're doing now, get them involved in it, and start to get full community ownership of this issue. And it goes back to some meetings that took place earlier this year, and one was with the League of Women Voters, where they kind of looked into the capacity issue, and there were a lot of people in this room afterwards who said, oh, we had no idea this was going on. That's a different conversation. We start from, well, we have an issue, maybe we could all get involved in this, rather than, hey, by the way, we're going to come back to you and ask you for taxes. We need to start educating now for two, starting now, because you'll never get to two if we don't do that. If we don't get community-wide buy-in, that we have an issue by having 600 kids in portables and what we're doing, then we're wasting our time. So we need to start that communication now and see if we can get people on board. And then they'll be the ones who help us get to phase two. Mm-hmm.
Don't forget we're sending 200 and some kids home in half a day.
Yes, we are.
Don't forget.
Yes, we are. Mm-hmm.
Well, Patrick, you brought up the communication workshop, and I know that Paul, you're working
yep.
on that, so I think that that's certainly the foundation mm-hmm. for you know, some of this conversation, too.
Yeah. So, sorry, anybody else?
No, we ended the Finance Committee meeting. I was just able to sit in for about the last half hour of it, and it was around the determining, you know, after bids, et cetera, how we're going to fund this and the best approach to doing that. And I'd like to ask the Finance Committee, you know, Paul already brought this up, but to, you know, you'll be bringing a recommendation to the full board. I think what will be helpful is for us to see some of your thought process, you know, to the board in minutes and maybe a little bit more structure, you know, to get to the full board so that we're listening to your thought process and not just coming in our three-step process and then hitting it all, which we don't do typically. Bob, you know, provides a recommendation, we get that. But I'm thinking that that would be helpful to have that backed up a little bit so we can hear what you're thinking about as you meet either in your regular Finance Committee meeting, the rest of us certainly welcome to come, but also if you meet separate from to hash out option A, option B, whatever you might be doing. So I leave that to you, Mr. Chair, to figure that out.
We can do that. I think that was kind of why I think we got a little bit stuck in the weeds when we were getting started. But yeah, we can certainly do that. Make sure that Bob puts that on our agenda.
Mm-hmm.
So that funding conversation, that funding decision, 0 to 100%, or however mm-hmm. doing, that's a spring conversation that should not defer or deter mm-hmm. the okay. vote on November 11th.
Yeah, absolutely not.
Phase one, phase two. So.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So,
I think what Eric is looking for, so if you're looking for some more details, some more granularity in terms of how we got from through our process, and that's certainly a valid request.
Yeah. And this isn't to add fuel to the fire, but simply to layer on another piece that we've had kind of laying on us, and it came up at the LEND meeting this past Friday, and that is the pension reform bill that's on the table. Right now does not include cost shifting to districts, but I called Peg Agnos, who's the executive director for LEND, and asked her, you know, to clarify this, and she said, no, it's not on the table now, but that doesn't mean it won't come back
Correct.
If the bill goes through committee. So that's, you know, this is another piece. That's why District 200 withheld some of their funding for their last referendum, which didn't pass, but that was some of the backlash from some residents, not, you know, all, but some, saying you need more skin in the game. But part of withholding is not knowing what's going on with that. So, you know, there's some other external stressors to this that we have to think about.
Yeah, I guess I would ask the Finance Committee, I mean, I understand short term, how do you fund this? But I think I'm going to assume that when you look at the plan, part of the plan, when you come back on funding, has to have a referendum. Unless you guys feel that we can fund the plan, which includes phase two, through just the bonds and the reserves. Otherwise, I think, you know, the plan has to include a referendum. And I don't know if you guys agree with that or not at this point, but I don't see how you get through the plan without that. And I think it has to be a part of the conversation. Otherwise, people will think that, you know, it was a surprise.
I don't think that was ever an idea. I think it was always part of phase two.
Mm-hmm. I also think it's a good ownership piece for the community, you know, to have to be a part of that conversation. And I think we're doing a really important work, you know, and again, thanks to Bob and his work and Paul, to be able to fund this without having to go to the taxpayer. It's always been the goal of the board and the administration to put off any ad fund referendum or any kind of referendum as much as possible, and I think that we're doing great due diligence around that. So, you know, to your point, John, I think that that's a part of the conversation.
Well, and you know, where I started thinking about this in terms of the plan, I stopped thinking it thinking about it in terms of the 16 classrooms, right? I started thinking about it in terms of the long-term plan. And, you know, just very simple calculations of if the long-term plan involves a K through 5, right, that's essentially 23 classrooms, right? You know, K through 5 is, you know, roughly 23 classrooms. And if we did this piece of the project, then we'd have 8 classrooms that would still have portables. So, I started thinking, okay, the 23 classrooms in the new building, I've got 8 I can fill. Right, so that leaves me 15 classrooms. I've got, if I go to full day kindergarten, that leaves me, that takes 7 classrooms in that building. So now I've got 8 classrooms left over, and I just started, it just got me thinking. Okay, we have to think about the plan because now I might have 8 extra classrooms sitting out in the district in the 6 or the 5 now K through 5 buildings because we built these things and. You know, you get flat enrollment or a couple of years of just a little bit of down enrollment, and all of a sudden I might have 8 to 10 empty classrooms sitting out there.
We don't see that in our demographic study, though. I just looked at it the other day, and even at, we're in that B option, which is where we've been living now for the last 4 years or so, we're still going to be, we still have pipeline that's going to fill in. And our biggest chunk of students is certainly from Glen Ellen, and when again in Cassara's study, even when he updated it last year, went back and looked at the turnover in the village, and
so if we stay flat, forget that I threw that in. If we stay flat. Mm-hmm. The way I was looking at it is we have 8 empty classrooms sitting in the district.
I think part of what Paul's presentation was bringing kids back to Glen Ellen that we're now busing out of Glen Ellen. And if you do that,
so that was my question. How many kids do we send out of our district because we can't take care of them?
We have roughly 400 students who are who have an IEP. Out of that, I would say about 60% of those students are in other districts receiving support and other support.
So probably in excess of 200 students.
Somewhere right around there. I'll get the exact numbers. I have them up on my.
We may not be able to fulfill the needs of those students. It's not like we can say
because some of those are
profound needs. Different.
Absolutely, I don't believe we will be able to bring everyone. Most districts can't meet everybody's needs, but we would bring some more back to our district and house more programs within our district. Currently, out of the districts that we work with, we have the fewest number of programs within our district. Other districts are carrying a larger burden. So I think it's an important piece for us to be looking at. How do we have more students back in Glen Ellen? And I believe full-day kindergarten is an important piece.
That ties into our dual language as well, because I was thinking, when you look at dual language and you have a half-a-day program, how does that, it's a rhetorical question, but how does that scaffold into the first grade, because then they're full-day? Are we doing the best work possible for our dual language program that we can, as we build that? And a half-a-day dual language program certainly.
This is what's going to make phase two difficult, because we're already trying to solution phase two with, full day kindergarten, those programs, bringing some of our students back. We're trying to solution that already. Staying where we are, going charter school. We don't know what phase. We don't know what those are. So phase two, we could put out. There's going to be a referendum. We can throw out a number, 100 million, 200 million, whatever. But it's going to be.
Let's not throw out those numbers.
Those are big numbers. Yeah.
But we don't know. That's the point. Is we don't know what it is because we don't haven't defined the resources and what we want to go. Full day kindergarten. It may be a study, but I'll play the other side. Do we need full day kindergarten? Maybe we want to bring more students back into Glen Ellen
or preschool
or preschool or something like that. So that's phase two's
Very conceptual.
I'm sure that we can fill the classrooms.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
we
right.
could, but
yes.
but guess what? That costs money.
Right.
I mean, if we say we're going to bring in more kids into our district, that's going to cost money.
Well,
in terms of operations,
remember, with students receiving specialized instruction, we're paying
right.
huge tuition costs to other districts.
Right.
But, huge tuition costs. That you've seen the, yeah. you've seen those yeah. come across your the finance committee, and you've approved those pieces.
And actually, we had a discussion about that. That it, depending on how much they do, it can also turn the other way. And right now, we're paying money. We could be in a situation where if we decide there's a certain group of students who'd like to get back. And we have facilities that can be that we can maybe take in some students even from other districts and be able to charge for that.
But Patrick, you're right. I mean, yeah, I think from a big picture viewpoint, does the board move that idea forward, knowing that we have a lot of work to do with it,
yeah.
but giving staff the opportunity to work with others to say, what would that look like? And how would the space configuration work? And how many classrooms?
You can get to phase two without doing phase one.
Yeah. I think it, you see how it works together.
Right.
Yeah, I disagree with that. Phase one could be different if we knew what phase two was. If you knew what phase two was, phase one might be different. So, as an example.
Unfortunately, we may wait around so long to phase two, we'll pass phase one up, and we'll be here stuck in the mud for another 10
years. It's time to move.
Yeah. I mean, that's the decision we made when we did this pivot, is are we, I guess the question was asked, are you prepared to move now? And that's the question we're going to be asked on November 11th. Are we prepared to move now to solve some of the problems, baby steps? We know we can't solve it all at once. That's close.
We've tried that for 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
We've struck out. So now is the time to do it in phases. And I agree with Patrick. If you never do phase one, we will never get to phase two, because phase two is going to look different 3 years from now, 4 years from now, from whatever we conceive today. Mm-hmm. And we need to educate the community, as Dean has expressed.
Okay, finance committee.
But the next piece is finance committee has a lot of time. I mean, we have a lot of time to really grapple with these big topics to talk about and to bring experts into the room. So that I appreciate the amount of time that they'll be given.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Oh, quick question. The grant that we got for Lincoln's roof. Yeah, how much is that?
$50,000.
$50,000?
And we have to do the work next summer.
Does it have to be at Lincoln? Because that was one of the questions. It can't be. You can't use that another.
We tried.
Try my roof.
It's a big room.
Whatever.
Don't put that in the paper. He was kidding.
That and $100 million.
Yeah. You
got to drive
some
to
action items.
thank
you, sorry. We have the, I apologize, the conversation around additional halftime ESL teacher at Ben Franklin Elementary for a conversation with that. I'll bring Lori forward to talk us through that recommendation.
Yeah.
Clear in the house.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, as you saw in the board report, we experienced far more students at Ben Franklin in our ESL program than we had expected. We projected anywhere between 15 and 17 kids to be in the program for this year. When we started school, we found that we had more than we had anticipated, with 32 kids now enrolled. We took some time to take a look at schedules and to try to be creative to problem solve before coming to ask for additional staff. We found that we haven't been able to meet the needs of the kids based on the current schedules and the current staffing. We do need to provide 30 minutes of ESL services to students on a daily basis, or 30 minutes of ESL services to students, and it's state law. It comes out of the literacy block for most of our kids. We do provide an additional 30 minutes out of the math block for those who are at level one. And so we are coming to you asking for an additional half-time teacher, effective, you know, whatever the board can take action, we can get somebody hired to help bring that ratio down closer to what is within our model within the district, which is closer to 26 or 24 students to one teacher. The program operates on a pull-out basis, so kids are pulled out in small groups based on their language level and taught by a teacher with specialized skills and strategies on how to help kids learn a second language or language acquisition. Mm-hmm. Is there anything you want to add there?
Nope. No, I think Finance Committee started with this conversation. I don't know if the people who are there want to continue or anyone else want to ask some questions.
I just highlighted that this is just a one-year recommendation, so right. just for this year.
Right.
And it, was it that people didn't register on time, or
the new? A lot of our new students who came in checked
come in late.
A second language on their home language survey, more so than ever at.
So are we in violation of the 30 minutes at this point, or are we getting
We're
the 30 minutes?
Pretty close.
But I want to clarify on what Erica mm-hmm. said. This is something that we need to do for this year, and if the trend continues, this half resource will be a continued resource as we go through the budgeting
as
process.
As we go through the budgeting and the staffing mm-hmm. process.
Correct.
Right. Depending on where our projections are.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you. Action items, consent agenda. Any board items board members would like removed from the consent agenda to be considered separately? Hearing none, may I have a motion to approve the reports and recommendations contained in the consent agenda, which include a lot of stuff, guys. Human resources, personnel report, employment recommendations, resignations, finance and facilities and operations, treasurer report, investment schedule, monthly revenue expenditure, summary report, summary of bills and payroll, school district payment order, vandalism, damage report, disposal of surplus property, 2002-14 FOIA report, and other matters, board meeting minutes of October 15th for both the regular and the closed meeting session.
Motion.
Second.
The roll call.
Mr. Kenwood?
Yes.
Mr. Alger?
Yes.
Mr. Kuchinski?
Yes.
Mrs. Nelson?
Yes.
Mr. Ellis?
Yes.
Mr. Esperanza?
Yes.
Okay, second action item, superintendent's recommendation, additional half-time ESL teacher at Ben Franklin School. Earlier this evening, the Finance Committee and the Board discussed the administration's recommendation to approve the addition of the ESL teacher at the Ben Franklin School at a cost of $23,000. The cost for this position will be absorbed in the current salaries and benefits ESL account. May I have a motion to approve the administration's recommendation as presented?
Moved.
Second.
Roll call.
Any discussion?
We got it. We had a second.
Yeah, we have a second, but do we need to add?
Oh, sorry, discussion. We just had one, but any more discussion?
No.
All right, great. Roll call.
Mr. Esperanza?
Yes.
Mrs. Nelson?
Yes.
Mr. Alger?
Yes.
Mr. Ellis?
Yes.
Mr.
Yes.
Mr. Kenwood?
Yes. Superintendent's report. Paul will give this report.
Yes, I will. So if you turn to page 43, it is our enrollment update. The best thing that I can say about it is stable, but I would like for you to review the document, how we've transitioned into a format that I think articulates very clearly where students are at the grade levels and the levels of the students. But overall, it is they're stable numbers. Questions? Comments, concerns.
Do we have any projection in an increase in our ESL population? Is there a way to
probably
clearly not Franklin?
Yeah, quite honestly, it's one of our most challenging trying to grapple with those numbers from year to year, based off of student movement and students coming in late summer, early fall. It's a number that we have struggled with, and other districts struggle with that number as well. We'll continue to examine it and refine it as we go forward, as we noticed, and we continue to track. And also looking at how many of our students are making growth and moving out and moving up levels of proficiency of English.
Julie, I don't know if you got this. The League of Women Voters had meeting where a demographer from DuPage County actually presented the trends in the county. I was sick that night, but I have written her to see if we can get a copy of that report. So I'm just curious to see if that might show
is she how finite that got in terms of trends. So I'm hopefully we'll get that report and we'll send them along.
We know those numbers continue to increase throughout the country, throughout Illinois, and in DuPage County. Our ELL numbers continue to increase, and so we will see that trend.
Okay.
That was the shortest report ever.
Board reports? Anybody?
And I'll just talk briefly about Lent, the meeting last Friday morning. This is the Legislative Education Network of DuPage, and we meet once a month. And certainly, I know you guys get this information. Always welcome to go. I typically go. Paul, this is an extra copy of the PowerPoint
sure it goes
that
out.
We've done. And this was interesting. This is also on one's website if anybody's interested. But our speaker was there's an update on some of the legislative stuff. I just want to share this piece because this is why our district and District 203 work together on this resolution that we're going to, have heard in November at the meeting. But this is a series of four slides that were titled, Can You Say Unfunded Mandates? So three were high school related. One was elementary and secondary related. And it's the recommendation, it's a House bill requiring ISBE, Illinois State Board of Education, to distribute to each school board information on screening instruments available to identify students who exhibit potential indicators of dyslexia and other reading disabilities, and to develop and distribute to each school board guidance on appropriate intervention strategies. So this is potentially, this is a bill that would potentially put school boards, my question to Peg was, is this our role? So this is just a really good example, and I know that's what legislators do. They write bills. I get that. But it's just another example of, more dollars and more requests of districts. So some interesting information there. Then we had a presentation that we've heard before. It was Ralph Martier, who's the executive director of the Center for Tax and Budget Accountability. Very interesting, very, very smart guy, and always does a good presentation. This was in particular about the pension reform, currently where we are, and also some pretty stark numbers in terms of how we get out of this as a state. But then also talked a little bit about graduated income tax, which has been out there for quite a while, but resurrected in terms of some new statistics. So some interesting information, and I'll just tell you that his call to LEND members was getting behind some kind of tax reform. It's the only way to get the state out of where we are with pensions. So good information, and I mentioned about the cost shift for pension reform. Not in it now, but certainly could be. I mentioned last time that I was going to be able to sit on a one-hour webinar from School Wires, an organization, and this one I sat in on for the hour was about connecting with the new digital parents. Really interesting information around digital natives, what I call the tether generation of parents, which is constant contact via cell phone with your child, and some of the statistics around how to what parents who are, call themselves digital parents are expecting in schools, in particular high school, which is why District 87 is going to bring your own device policy to use. So very interesting. I'm happy to share this. But I thought this statistic was interesting. There's been a 65% increase since 2009. There was a survey parents using online learning or meeting tools, which is driving parents' desire to see more technology within the school system. Because they themselves are, and whether go to meetings, using these tools, et cetera. So that was kind of interesting, and I sent all the information to Julie, too. Last thing is I just want to do a call out to some members of the district staff. You probably read this, but over the weekend there was a fire at the Mineral Lakes Apartments in Lombard, and we have seven families in Forest Glen that have been affected, and one family that we know of in Churchill, correct? So I just want to publicly thank our two community outreach chairs, Rachel Alcorn and Therese Crawford of Forest Glen, for stepping up. And also Mrs. Hornacek and Mr. Kluski of Forest Glen and Churchill principals, and Kate McCluskey, Heather Britton, and Jerry
Adams here at the district, Adkins here at the district, for helping to coordinate collecting needs for these families. So it's you know, it's what we do. So.
Yep. Anybody else?
We did finance pretty much. We pretty much. Issues. I'm not sure about what. We talked about the halftime. Yourself, teacher from Franklin. Bob gave a preliminary discussion of the tax levy, and we started the 11th of the school facility planning update, which carried on to the full board. This morning, I attended the PTA council. Erica was also there. Actually, Paul gave a really nice presentation to the council.
Anybody else? Okay. Upcoming meetings, November 11th, Board of Education regular meeting, 7:30 p.m., Central Services, and November 25th, Central Services at 7:30 p.m. Are there any other matters that people want to talk about to be considered?
Nope.
Okay, public participation. Is there anyone who would like to address the board at this time? No one? Again? Okay, great. We're going to adjourn to closed session then. The board has determined it has a need to adjourn to closed session to discuss the appointment, employment, compensation, discipline, performance, or dismissal of specific employees of the district or legal counsel for the district, including hearing testimony on a complaint lodged against an employee or against legal counsel for the district to determine its validity. I have a motion to adjourn to the closed session.
Second.
Roll call.
Mr. Elder?
Yes.
Mr. Kuchinski?
Yes.
Mrs. Nelson?
Yes.
Mr. Kenwood?
Yes.
Mr. Swanson?
Yes.
And we may be taking action coming out of closed session.
We will. Okay.
We will be taking
action.
Mm-hmm.
Mr.
Elder?
Yes.
Okay. I apologize.
Not sure how long it's going to be. Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we are in open session, please. May I remind everyone we're in open session?
Thank you, John.
Thanks, John.
May I have a motion to close the open session?
Motion.
Second.
May I have a second? Thank you. Motion's closed. We're closed.
Can I vote? A unanimous vote?
Roll call vote?
No. A unanimous vote, right?
Aye for closing this open session. Aye. Any nays?
No nays.
Okay. Thank you.